Well, good evening. It's good to have everybody here. We have been studying a series of lessons on creation versus evolution. I call it the Battle of Origins. Our particular lesson here, number four, is called A Scientific Case for Creation. We are looking at scientific evidence that show or proves the creation model as opposed to the evolution model. And here we're talking about true science. We're not talking about what scientists say, although we are going to mention some quotes from different scientists. But we're going to look at the laws of science and see how it compares between the creation model and the evolution model. We began by noticing a law. We call it the law of causality, or the law of cause and effect. It says that for every material effect, there has to be an adequate antecedent cause. There has to be an adequate cause, and antecedent means before. So it has to be something that existed before to cause something to happen. I gave the example earlier in one of my lessons, putting a book up here on the table. And I leave the room and I come back and the book's on the floor. Well, what would cause that to go from the table to the floor? Well, we know for sure that the book didn't do it itself because it's not an adequate cause. If I see an ant crawling across the table, I know that the ant didn't do it because it's not an adequate cause. And yet if I see some children playing around up here around the table, I could probably assume that maybe one of the kids knocked it off, because that would be an adequate cause. So we see that there has to be something that existed before that would cause something to happen. And so we look at the universe. What caused it? And that's one of the big debates between evolution and creation. Evolutionists, as we've noticed, really don't have an adequate cause for the creation of the universe. We noted that there's only three ways that this universe can be in existence. Either it is eternal, it created itself, or it was created by someone or something that we call God. And even scientists now say that the universe is not eternal. They would like for it to be eternal because that way they wouldn't have to try to explain the beginning of the universe. But the universe is not eternal. So it has to be that either it created itself or someone created it. And we looked at the evidence for the creation of the universe doing it by itself, and the evidence is not there. Even the scientists say this is a big problem. And so we look at God, the creator of the universe. We went through and did kind of a logical argument on what would cause the universe. It went something like this. The universe exists. We know that. We see the universe. We live in the universe. We are here. Something is here. And so if nothing always existed, then nothing would be here today because nothing produces nothing. It doesn't produce something. So the universe exists. It's here. Something had to have happened. So then we notice that therefore something or someone has always existed. Something's here now, so something has always existed. But that which has always existed is either matter or mind. We can put everything in those two categories. Matter being physical, mind being spiritual. So there's a physical world and there's a spiritual world. One of those two have always been here, has always existed. But as we've noted in our previous lessons, and even scientists tell us this, matter does not exist forever. They realize that the universe had a beginning and the universe will have an end. So if matter is not eternal, then what's eternal? Well, logically, that means that mind is eternal, or spirit is eternal. And the mind, according to the Bible, is called God. So that's the logical argument for the existence of God and the cause of the universe. But then we also noted that when people say, okay, if God caused the universe, then what caused God? Well, that's a legitimate question. But one thing we need to remember is that this law of causality does not apply to the spiritual world. Remember, it says that every material effect has to have an adequate antecedent cause. Doesn't say every spiritual effect, every physical effect. So the law of causality, saying that something had to have caused it, does not apply to the spiritual world. In Psalm 102, verses 25 through 27, it talks about God living forever, being here forever. It says, of old you laid the foundation of the earth, and the heavens are the work of your hands. They will perish, but you will endure. Yes, they will all grow old like a garment, like a cloak. You will change them, and they will be changed. But you are the same, and your years will have no end. Yes, God is eternal. He has always been here. So God is the uncaused cause. He is eternal. He didn't have a beginning. I know that's hard for us to comprehend. We can't really get our minds around this idea of eternity, that God never had a beginning. He has always been here, and He will always be here. No beginning, no end. He caused the universe, and He is uncaused because He's eternal. He is the eternal being that has no beginning, and He has no end. He is the cause. He's the creator of the universe, and He is uncaused. I know that may sound kind of like talking in circles, but that's the essence of God. He's all-powerful. He's all-knowing. He is eternal, and therefore He is the adequate antecedent cause for the universe. So how did the universe come into existence? That's the question we ask at the beginning, and then we've looked at the different answers. So how did it come into existence? Just as we read in Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. That's how God started His Bible, His Word that He has given to us. We are His creation. Well, I want us to look at another scientific law. We've looked at the law of causality. Now I want us to look at the law of biogenesis. Anybody have any idea what the law of biogenesis is? Okay, so Verd is saying that it's life begets life. Well, that's true. It says, in the field of biology, there is another commonly accepted and widely used law of science, and it is called the law of biogenesis. Now, this law was set forth many years ago. It isn't something that's new, but it's been around for a long time. And it says in both theory and experimental evidence has shown this to be true in all living organisms. And what is that? That life comes only from preceding life of its own type or kind. Life only comes from life. Life doesn't come from non-life. That's important. But in times past, it was a common belief that some life could begin by spontaneous generation. In fact, from the time of the ancient Romans through the Middle Ages and up until the late 19th century, that's in the late 1800s, it was generally accepted that some life forms arose spontaneously from non-living matter. Such spontaneous generation appeared to occur primarily in decaying matter. So people thought that some life began by spontaneous generation. But the first serious argument against that belief of spontaneous generation was made in 1668 by Francisco Redi, an Italian physician and poet. At that time, it was widely believed that maggots arose spontaneously in rotting meat. But Redi believed that maggots developed from eggs laid by flies. Now, all of us have seen a dead animal or something laying out in the yard or on the road or whatever, and it doesn't take long for those maggots to get there. And the people back then, they would just see something dead, and then all of a sudden the maggots would appear. So in their minds, they thought, well, it just appeared out of nothing. They just generated these maggots. But Redi understood that maggots came from the eggs of flies. And in order to prove that, he did an experiment. He set out meat in a variety of flasks. A flask are those glass tubes that it's kind of like a glass bowl with a long neck on it, glass neck on it. So he set out some meat in a variety of flasks, some open to the air and some sealed completely and others covered with gauze. And as he expected, maggots appeared only in the open flask in which the flies were able to reach the meat and lay the eggs. If the flies were prevented from getting to the meat, there were no maggots. So he says, I have proven that maggots do not form spontaneously. They come from flies. Well, in spite of this well-executed experiment, the belief of spontaneous generation continued. They understood then that maggots didn't generate spontaneously, but they believed still other life forms did. And even Redi himself continued to believe that life could form spontaneously in some circumstances. So the debate continued for many centuries. But in 1859, now that really hasn't been that long ago, 1859, the debate was finally laid to rest by young French chemist Louis Pasteur. I'm sure most of you have heard of that name. If you took a science class, that name would come up. I don't know if they still teach this or not. It's been a long time since I've been in school, but I'm sure they probably do. The French Academy of Sciences sponsored a contest for the best experiment either proving or disproving spontaneous generation. As I said, this debate of spontaneous generation had gone on for centuries. And finally, the French Academy of Sciences says, okay, we're going to settle this matter once and for all. We're going to give a prize to anybody that can either prove or disprove spontaneous generation. So I'm sure there were a lot of scientists there that got together and they did all kinds of experiments, but one was really proven successful. Pasteur's experiment was rather simple, but it was effective. He boiled meat broth in a flask. Remember, we're talking about one of those kind of a glass bowl with a long glass neck on it. So he put this meat broth in the flask, and then he heated up the neck of the flask until it became pliable, and he bent it into the shape of an S. So it had a big dip in it. Well, this would allow air to enter the flask, but any airborne microorganisms could not. They would be trapped, or they would settle in that, by gravity, in that dip in the neck of the flask. Well, just as Pasteur had expected, no microorganisms grew in the flask. So then, Pasteur tilted the flask so that the broth reached the lowest point in that S-curve in the neck of the flask, and there airborne particles could reach the broth, and rapidly it became cloudy with life, microorganisms all over. So Pasteur had refuted the theory of spontaneous generation. It doesn't happen. And he convincingly demonstrated that microorganisms are everywhere, even in the air. You know, the microscope was just becoming pretty popular, and they were able to see these little creatures everywhere. But they thought it was basically on solid surfaces. But Pasteur showed that these microorganisms are transferred through the air. They aren't just laying on a table or a desk or the floor. They're everywhere. Scientist David Kirk observed this. He said, by the end of the 19th century, there was general agreement that life cannot arise from non-living under conditions that now exist upon our planet. The dictum, all life from pre-existing life, became the dogma of modern biology from which no reasonable man can be expected to dissent. So there's a law in science now called the law of biogenesis. Life only comes from life. Life does not spontaneously generate itself. Down through the years, thousands of scientists in various disciplines have established the law of biogenesis. It's just that, a scientific law stating that life comes only from pre-existing life. Now, it's interesting to note that this law of biogenesis was established firmly in science long before the modern theory of evolution came about. And the reason I say that is because what did evolution believe? That life came from non-living matter. And yet their law of biogenesis states just the opposite of that. It's kind of like the law of causality. Everything has to have a cause, they say. But then they get to the beginning of the universe and they got a problem, so they say, well, except for the beginning of the universe. It didn't have to have a cause. Well, it's the same thing with life. All life comes from pre-existing life, except at the beginning when no life existed and now life began. So they're not being consistent in their laws. They have a problem with the theory of evolution. Today, students in high school and college biology classes are taught the importance of Louis Pasteur's work. They say that it exposed the false belief of spontaneous generation. And it did. It was a great advance in science. But then students are given in great detail the history of how Pasteur triumphed over mythology, over these pagan beliefs, and provided science with its finest hour as he discredited the popular concept of spontaneous generation. But then, in almost the next breath, students are informed by this same professor that says spontaneous generation has been proven false. They turn around and say, well, evolution was started by, you guessed it, spontaneous generation. It doesn't make sense. It's not logical. And yet, that is what evolutionists say. That's what evolutionists teach. Nobel laureate George Wald of Harvard offered his observation on how to solve this problem of how life began, the conflict that comes up, that spontaneous generation does not exist, but yet it did exist at one time because we have life. Okay, so he says this. We're going to look at several quotes here of what he says. He begins by saying, the reasonable view was to believe in spontaneous generation. The only alternative is to believe in a single primary act of supernatural creation. There is no third alternative. Now, that's interesting. He says the reasonable view. Now, whose reasonable view? Of course, it's the evolutionist reasonable view. Because the only alternative is to believe in a single primary act of supernatural creation. In essence, what he's saying, we can't believe in this God, so we have to believe in spontaneous generation because there's nothing else to believe in. It's one of those two. Either life began spontaneously or it was created. So then he goes on and says, most modern biologists, having reviewed with satisfaction the downfall of spontaneous generation, yet are unwilling to accept the alternative belief in special creation. Therefore, they are left with nothing. We're not going to believe in God. Spontaneous generation has been disproven. So basically, he says, we're left with nothing. At least he's being honest here. Then he says, I think a scientist has no choice but to approach the origin of life through a hypothesis of spontaneous generation. What the controversy reviewed above showed to be true or to be untenable is only the belief that living organisms arise spontaneously under present conditions. In other words, he's saying, yes, that law is true. Spontaneous generation is false. Life does not come from non-life, at least today. But apparently there had to be a time when it did happen because life is here and I'm not going to believe in God. Of course, that isn't what he actually said, but that's what he means. Then he says, we have now to face a somewhat different problem. How organisms may have arisen spontaneously under different conditions in some former period. And granted, they do that no longer. So again, he's saying that spontaneous generation is false, at least in our present time. But it did happen some point in a distant past. He says, to make an organism demands the right substances in the right proportions and in the right arrangement. We do not think that anything more is needed, but that's problem enough, he says. Notice he says, to make an organism demands the right substances, the right proportions, and the right arrangements. And we don't think there's anything more needed, but that's a big enough problem, and it is. We talked about simple things like, well, I say simple. We talked about things like a camera. Scientists understand that you cannot just take parts of a camera and put it together and shake it around, and somehow it's going to magically all be put together and work. It's not going to happen. I don't care how many times you try to shuffle that stuff around and mix it up. It takes intelligence. It takes, like we said, cause and effect. An adequate antecedent cause. Somebody that's adequately able to do that, that existed before the camera to put it together. They understand that. They understand a house cannot build itself. But yet they want to turn around and say that life began by itself. That the human eye began by itself, even though a camera cannot exist by itself. And so they say here, Life is complicated. It demands the right substances, the right proportions, and the right arrangement, and everything has to come together perfectly in order for life to exist. And he says, that's a big problem, and it is. But they're going to ignore that problem. He says, one has only to contemplate the magnitude of this task to concede that the spontaneous generation of a living organism is impossible. Spontaneous generation of a living organism is impossible. This is Dr. George Wald saying all this. But then notice what he says right after that. Yet, here we are. As a result, I believe, of spontaneous generation. Now, people, Dr. Wall is not some crazy person. He's not some uneducated person. He is a very intelligent person, a very knowledgeable person. And he says that spontaneous generation has been proven false. He says life cannot come from spontaneous generation. Spontaneous generation of a living organism is impossible. Yet, I believe that we're all here because of spontaneous generation. Where's the common sense? Where is the logic? There isn't any. But this is what evolutionists have. This. Everything has to have a cause. Well, that is except for the beginning of the universe, of course. Life begins from life. Well, that is except at the beginning. And then that didn't happen. So all their laws that they stand upon, they have to set aside in order to promote their theory of evolution. How sad. Dr. Wald states that there are only two ways that life could have begun. And we've looked at those. One is creation. He did mention that. Some special miraculous event, creation. The other thing is spontaneous generation. Those are the only two ways that life could have begun. He noted that there is no third option, and there isn't. So it's one of these two ways. We are here, we exist. So how do we get here? By creation or spontaneous generation? So that brings us back to our question that we began with and that scientists always ask is, how did life begin? Well, Dr. Wall says he believes in spontaneous generation. Even though it's been proven wrong, it's impossible, he says, but it happened. So yes, evolutionists have a problem. All their scientific laws are violated when they begin with the theory of evolution. They proclaim and teach that the myth of spontaneous generation has been proven wrong by Louis Pasteur. Yet at the same time, they proclaim and they teach that evolution started by spontaneous generation. So we ask the question, which is it? They're speaking out of both sides of their mouth. Spontaneous generation does not happen. And they turn around and say, well, it did happen at the beginning. They say that the cause of law of cause and effect always works. Something had to have had a cause in order to exist. And yet they set that law aside in order to believe in evolution. You can't have it both ways, even though they try. In their publications and in our children's classrooms, evolutionists skim over this problem, and they just hope, well, nobody pays much attention to it. Nobody notices. But among themselves, they know they have a big problem. Evolutionist Dr. Jastrow, we've quoted him several times, wrote the following. At present, science has no satisfactory answer to the question of the origin of life here on Earth. Perhaps the appearance of life on Earth is a miracle. Now, scientists are reluctant to accept that view, but their choices are limited. Either life was created on the Earth by the will of a being outside the grasp of scientific understanding, or it evolved on our planet spontaneously through chemical reactions occurring in non-living matter lying on the surface of the planet. So here he says, we've got a problem. And either life began, now notice this part. Life was created on the earth by the will of a being outside the grasp of scientific understanding. And that's exactly what we have. There is no scientific experiment that can prove God. Just you do some kind of experiment and there it is, right in front of your face, God exists. Now, if you use logic, if you use reasoning, if you use common sense, it is there. But scientists don't want to look at that. They just want to see some kind of experiment, kind of like Louis Pasteur's experiment proving spontaneous generation wrong. But yet, what is science? Science is supposed to be the study of facts and see what direction it goes. What does the evidence point to? And they're pretty good at that, except for when it comes to the beginning of the universe and the beginning of life. All the evidence points to God as the creator of the universe. All the evidence points to God as the beginning of life, creating life. And yet, they just can't wrap their minds around it. They don't want to believe that, so they have to believe in spontaneous generation. They have to believe that the universe happened without a cause. It violates all of their scientific laws. How sad. Highly educated people know that the evidence points toward God, but they just will not accept that. How sad. He goes on and says, the first theory places the question of the origin of life beyond the reach of scientific inquiry. In other words, science cannot demonstrate God. There's not an experiment that we can do. It is a statement of faith in the power of a supreme being, not subject to the laws of science. The second theory that he just talked about, like spontaneous generation, is also an act of faith. The act of faith consists in assuming that the scientific view of the origin of life is correct without having concrete evidence to support that belief. Now, here's an evolutionist. Here's a scientist. And like I said, you're not going to hear this. You're not going to read about this in their textbooks. You're not going to read about this in their TV programs. They present evolution as fact. And if you disagree, there must be something wrong with you. But yet, notice what they've said. We've quoted several scientists. And they know they have a problem. And they know that life and the universe began only one of two ways. Either by total complete accident, or it was created by a supreme being. And yet they turn around and say, we're going to go with a complete accident. We're not going to believe in God. So there you have it. Evolution is a religion of faith. Now you need to remember that. They'll say evolution is not a religion, but evolution is a religion. It is their belief system. They put their faith and trust in science. And yet all their scientific laws tell them that the universe and the life in it could not happen without a cause or by spontaneous generation. And yet they still hold on to that belief, just as Dr. Jastrow said, without any evidence to support that belief. Christianity, on the other hand, is also a religion of faith. We have faith and trust in God and His Word, and all the evidence supports what the Bible says, that God created the heavens and the earth. Okay, we will continue on next week. We're out of time, so I want to thank everybody for their attention and their comments.